Hey, I'm Bob Dassey, and you're listening to Improv Nerd.
Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy.
Hey, everybody, this is Jimmy Crane. You're listening to another episode of Improv Nerd, and I want to just talk to you for just a second about the Cambridge Footlights. Because they're embarking on a world tour, and they are proud to present their biggest show of the year, Lagoon, which will be hitting the Blackout Cabaret at the Second City Training Center in Chicago on September 14th. Now, just in case you haven't heard of the Cambridge Footlights, they boast such former members as John Oliver, you may have heard of him, John Cleese, you may have heard of him too, and Emma Thompson, I'm sure you've heard of her. So, for tickets, visit the Second City website and use the code NERD for $2 off. I also want to talk to you about Rhetoric Coffee. It is a subscription coffee service that sends you this amazing freshly roasted coffee. And each roast is completely unique. You won't taste these complex flavors anywhere else. And here's the coolest part. They commission original art directly from some of the coolest comic book artists, and they hand screen them on each bag. So you get like this little piece of original artwork. You will feel good about drinking this delicious coffee because, now are you ready for this? Because they go beyond fair trade, not just with the coffee, but how they pay the artists. Now, if you go to Rhetoric Coffee, and that's spelled R-H-E-T-O-R-I-C, and you put in the code IMPROV, okay, put in the code IMPROV, you will save 30% off your first order. And don't forget, if you like Improv Nerd, like what we're doing here, our interviews and my crazy ramblings, go to iTunes and like us. Write us a nice review, please. I'm begging you. Write us a nice review because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Scares you, huh? How crazy I got when I was begging for something that I wanted. I'll save the crazy for later. Our guest today is Bob Dassey. Bob Dassey is a legendary improviser and teacher. He performs with his wife, Stephanie Ware, in a show called Weird Ass. He also performs with Rich Tallarico and Craig Kakowski in a show, Dazzariski, which he says he's been performing with, I remember, 17 years. We talked to him about his incredible work ethic and his philosophy about getting better at improv. He also demonstrates to me, Mr. Negative, the importance of making positive choices in a scene. We do a little demonstration, which I think you'll really like, and how he keeps growing as a person. Before we get to the episode, I just want to say I have a lot of gratitude today for my wife, Lauren. She is so supportive. You know, and this isn't an easy time. As you guys know, we just had a new baby. It's Betsy is 2 months old, and it's been crazy. And, you know, I'm a little down on my career, to be totally honest with you guys. As you know, I've been doing this podcast for 5 years. It does not pay much money at all. We sell a little advertising, but that's it. And that is not enough to buy diapers and formula and doctor's appointments for Betsy. And I've just been, this last week, I've just been totally in fear about money. Like, what am I doing, you know? And I need to bring in more money. And it's almost like I bought a car, drove it around for 2 months, and now I realize I can't pay for it. And I really would like to take it back to the dealership, but the dealership isn't going to take it back because I signed a contract. I signed a lease for 36 months. So that's where I am, and it just made me really angry. And I need to do some different things in my career, stuff that actually pays. Enjoy it, doing it, and paying at the same time. That's my goal. And Lauren, we're going to go out to dinner in a couple minutes, we're going to talk about that. And I just have a lot of gratitude because I grew up in a house, as you know, that I didn't get much support for my art, doing my improv and my comedy and my acting and all that stuff. And I have a wife today that is very supportive. And I'm really, really, really grateful. I know you're probably a little disappointed that I wasn't as curmudgeonly and as angry as I usually am, and I will definitely take that note and work on it for next time. You're going to love this episode. I've known Bob for such a long time. He's just a great person and a great improviser, And here it is. It's so much wisdom. So much wisdom. Here it is. The Bob Dassey interview. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd.
Bob Dassey, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Happy to be here, Jimmy.
You said you're doing 8 shows with Dazarisky in a very short period of time.
Yes, we usually we've regulated down, so we've been doing once a month in Los Angeles, but this little tour that we just did, we did 3 shows in Kansas City, 2 shows in St. Louis, and 3 shows in Chicago, in a 7-day period, and we're doing basically a year worth of shows.
It's kind of feel like the old days when you did multiple shows in a week.
Yeah, it's there's an element of old days, but since Dazarisky has never done, we've done one-off improv festivals. But we've been traveling together on train and plane and cab and whatnot. And so, I mean, we've known each other for 23 years or whatnot.
Craig Kukowski and Rich Tellerico.
Yes. We actually tend to be a good travel companions because we're all we keep to ourselves. And then we'll come together for a card game and then we'll go back to being our, you know, quiet.
I see the three of you like no problem getting your own quiet time.
Oh, yeah. We're all like quiet time. We all understand. We're all like, okay.
Because would this be fair to say that all three of you, in some ways, are introverts?
Gosh, you know, there's elements of it. I think like Craig might be quieter than I am, and but we all like to pull away. I think that we're all. I don't know. I know Craig has 2 siblings. I have 2 siblings. And Rich, gosh, does he have 1 or 2 siblings? But I think we all have that, full house, want time alone kind of thing.
Now, you grew up in Streamwood, Illinois.
Illinois. St. Reemwood, yes.
St. what?
St. Reemwood, we call it.
Why'd you call it that?
Because it's spelled with an S-T and then Reemwood. Okay. St. Reemwood, see?
And you actually went to high school with Matt Dwyer.
Matt Dwyer,
and
yes.
Who is a great stand-up comedian and improviser as well.
Yes.
And we talked to Matt, and he said you were very smart and sophisticated in high school. And it seemed like you didn't belong there.
Well, that's very sweet of Matt to say. I would say equally to him that we did not belong there. It was like, not that there was anything wrong with Streamwood. It was that we were exploring outside of our boundaries. And I remember being attracted to Streamwood's about 45 minutes outside of Chicago.
Blue collar, right?
Blue collar, definitely. Mm-hmm. First suburbs, accessible by the train line. My dad used to work for Zenith and would take the train into town from Bartlett to... wherever. I was venturing out with music and Matt was venturing out with theater and another friend of ours, Tom Camus, who was part of our first improv group in Streamwood. They were the ones that pulled me in because I was, doing smart ass comments in the back of English class with Tom. And when they had this thing to put together this improv group, they asked me to audition.
And what kind of stuff were you doing back then?
making teachers angry and being a bad student.
Were you a bad student?
I was a good student. I think that's why I got away with it. I was strong enough. Like, I kept my grades up, but I was a little smart ass. But, in a general sense, as we're all smart asses, I suppose. I was in band. I was kind of a band geek. I was not.
What instrument did you play?
Saxophone. Alto saxophone. I did all the bands, jazz band, marching band, concert band, all that, pep band. So I had like a social nerdy, group, but was not, definitely not cool, but also was not trying to be cool. I just didn't, I was just trying to be myself, Jimmy. Difficult age.
Yeah, well, I still don't know how to do that. So you went to college. You went to NIU.
Yes.
And your senior year of college, your brother, Ed, is that right?
That's correct.
He suggests taking classes at Second City Northwest.
That is true. Ed was watching shows at Second City Northwest.
What was it in Ed that he saw in you that said, Bob, you really should be doing this?
Well, he wanted us to, because we were definitely, we would mimic Three Stooges and Marx Brothers, and we would do all the, physical gags, and we were very physical and very funny, and we, we'd just goof around. We got we're brothers, so we got each other's comedy really good. And so when I was off at school, he would watch the Second City shows and they would announce classes, and he's like, this is something we should do. And he had been saying it for a while. He would say it every time he saw a Second City show. He'd be like, buddy, we should take classes. And so my last semester in at Northern, I said, okay, let's take classes. And I would drive down every Saturday to take classes at the Second City Northwest.
Which was what, like 2 hours?
Yeah, about that.
Okay.
Give or take. But I would stay in for the weekend at my parents' house. We had Stephen Colbert was our first teacher, and then Dave Rozowski, then Steve Carell for level 3, and then this guy, John Holtzen, for 4 and 5.
Do you remember anything from that you still use today?
Well, I remember having a discussion with Stephen Colbert about what was offensive on stage.
This is back in what,
90? This was 92.
Okay.
And I told him, I was like, I got a pretty thick skin. I'm the youngest. I was a little fat kid, so I had a strong defensive mechanism that is still active today, protective and whatnot. So I was like, nothing really offends me. So what is offensive on stage? And we just kind of had that discussion where, when you're offending somebody else's sensibilities and beliefs and whatnot, it's like that you will be aware of it. So it's that you're approaching it, with some level of compassion. You don't just want to rip on people for their different beliefs.
But the thing is, because I've known you a long time, yeah. I don't find you to be an offensive person. I find you to be a very positive, nice person.
Right.
How have you developed that?
Well, I've learned a ton about being nice from my wife, Stephanie. I need to learn a lot more about being nice. Just being courteous to your fellow man, I think is, something that, I don't know if that's true. I don't know if I was so nice in the beginning when I was in improv. I fell in love with this stuff and I was driven for it. And I was like driven with people that were also driven with it. And if people weren't driven with it, I didn't really give them a lot of time and whatnot. So I think just over time, realizing I'm still learning how to create relationships, long-term relationships or deepened relationships. I don't know if that was ever instinctual in me. There was something really open about the improv community in the early 90s that made it like a second college. Where we were all in classes, we were all learning, we were all discussing the topics and whatnot and doing our jobs and hanging out. So it was like an elongated college and a brand new education. So I know improv has affected that because, just communicating and being able to read each other, I think is just a huge part of what improv has brought me. So
yeah. How is Stephanie... helped you become a nicer person? Does she say, hey, Bob, you're out of line here, or is it more by example?
Well, she's definitely one to lead by example. I admire her for that. I was raised by leading by lecture.
By your parents? Like, if you did something,
yes,
it would be a lecture.
It'd be lectures. Yeah, my mom, and they did their best with us. I'm still alive. They did great. They did their job. I do feel like I tend to fall into lecture with my kids and Steph and I talk about this and she's like, their eyes gloss over. They're 8 and 6. They don't have the capacity to even understand the logic or whatever that I'm giving them. Not that they're unable to understand logic, but when it's in a lecture form, nobody, that's why I made jokes in school, because I was bored of being lectured my education. It was never a good way to get that. So Steph has shown me, she'll put her hand on my shoulder, it's like, okay, they're not hearing this. Or she will say, it's like, be nice and stop being an asshole, and I appreciate that.
So you go through Second City, you go through Northwest, you come down to Chicago, and you start taking classes at Second City and I.O.
Yep.
And you said that it really wasn't until you started to play Armando that things changed for you as an improviser.
Yeah, I think that when I got on the first group I was on was with the Lost Yetis, and that was with I'll just go with Ed Dassey, Brian Blokovich, Tim Miller, Joe Slimon, Joe Yao, Lori Spiewak was on there for a while, Katie Mahaffey, Nay Roberts, and later Stephanie Weir and Seamus McCarthy, that was a group where we played really well together. We were like a rolling football team in a way. We were just physical, you know. We were such a dumb guys group that, you know, Stephanie and Katie went off and formed an all-woman group because they had enough testosterone. And I see the trend. Everyone's getting tired of testosterone, which is great. But in that safe group, I developed a lot of habits or instincts that, you know, I felt if I threw something out there, somebody would catch it. And that was our team. But when I did Armando, it was not intentionally so, but it was more like every man for themselves, every person for themselves, I should say. Whereas it wasn't about doing the same thing that I did with Los Yetis. It was like, okay, you got to participate and add and make your partner look good. I think that I was doing a lot of, my partners were making me look good. Hopefully I was doing the same to them. I think we really did have a group mind in that sense where we took care of each other. But Armando felt more like, oh, you better start taking care of other people first before you take care of yourself.
Well, it was a very intimidating group. I know when I played, sure, you know, when it first began, I was scared probably for the first 6 months because you had the best of the best, you know, and these people played, you know, they played for real.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, it is true, the adage of if you want to get better, play with better people. And I know that when I was surrounded with Armando folks, that I was challenged in a way, in a totally different way. Again, Lost Yetis was the greatest at doing, we just felt really great doing Harold in its wide open possibilities, and we would try to take advantage of that, and it was very playful. But Armando was not Harold; it was a very different beast. And so, yeah, when you were playing with people, I remember being called out once for, you know, referencing Socrates in book form, and I knew that he hadn't published, and Plato published his stuff. But
was that Noah?
No, I think it was. It might have been Valancourt, I think.
Okay, Paul Valancourt.
Yeah, Paul Valancourt. But the point is that I had to be sharper. Right. There was no laziness in Armando. You had to be on.
But
your
the game. Thing that I've always admired about you is you were a guy that just kept getting better and better and better.
Oh, thanks, buddy.
Because there was this work ethic. Where is that coming from?
Oh, that just comes from Midwestern roots, and you know, I did the same. While I was doing improv, I was also doing computers. And so I had this great balance of left brain, right brain. And so I was doing, I was working at the Board of Trade and Sears Tower and doing all these computer things. And you had to show up for work, like we all did. And you know, I love that about Chicago and about the Midwest, is that there is a great work ethic. So I think my parents showed up for work. They showed that a hard job, you do a good job and there's rewards, at least early on. Early on in their lives. I think I took that by just approaching, it's what I loved to do. I wanted to do it all the time, and I wanted to do it to the best of my abilities. And I wanted to get better. I was looking for ways. And I remember distinctly the reason I mentioned in Armando, it was a distinct memory, because I remember sitting on the sidelines and an instinct came to me to do something. And then I suppressed that instinct. And then I said, no, this is how I jump and let the net appear. I'm going to throw this thing out, not sure who's going to catch it, but I'm going to, I think it's to serve the scene. And so I stepped out and threw it towards these guys or gals, and they caught it. And it was a great feeling of like to take chances, but be cognizant that the chance isn't just random, that it is serving the scene. And so it was like a consciousness appeared in me. It was like, okay, I serve what's going on there. And from there, I can get inspired. And if inspiration comes from there and the scene is needing something, then I can join. And it was just a way to practice a discipline that that you don't always get an opportunity to exercise. You know, the exercise is like, do they need me or do they not? Is this right or is it wrong? And to take that judgment and put it away and just serve whatever is going up on stage and let that be the directive. And so I felt very conscious of that when I was.
So how did you stay focused in that? Because when we all start out, the first 5 or 6 years, or you go and you do Armando and you have shitty shows after shitty shows, mm-hmm. to keep going, what do you tell yourself? What is the thing that keeps you, hey, this is my passion, this is what I love to do, I'm a hard worker, it's going to pay off, that hope?
Well, I think sometimes, and as much as internally you want to be like, I'm going to drive towards this, there is externally, when you get feedback from your peers or people that you admire or even the audience, but you don't want to put too much weight into it, but that does spur you on a little bit. It's like, okay, I think I'm doing this right. But the danger in of that is to listen to that wholesale. And I'm like, oh, I made him laugh. I'm great at this. It's like, that's not the payoff. You know, making the audience laugh. It is making sure you've done your job. And so there's a balance between asking yourself, did I do it or did I not? And I love telling this story about doing Armando for a while. I was in need of a note. And you know, the longer you do this, the less notes you get. And so I asked Mick Napier. I said, "Hey, Mick, you're seeing me in Armando." I was like, "Can I bother you to give me one note, just one note of anything at all?" He's like, "All right, I'll watch the first half." He's in the show, but I'll watch it. And then in the second half, I'll give you a note. So he watched me in the first act and came off afterwards. And he told me, here's my note for you. I would say roughly 80% of the time, you would choose a lower status character. And I was like, oh, that's great. Okay. And I thought about that. And I said, okay, well, if I need to exercise higher status characters, then I gotta stop doing all low status characters. And so I stopped doing low status characters. And every time I came out there, I came out as a high status character. And I remember doing a scene. I actually mentioned this when I talked to Miles a couple weeks ago. I did a scene with Miles Stroth, and I came out as a prostitute. A high status prostitute, and he was a young John, and I don't ever tend to teach status in scenes, but again, it's an awareness of like, what is your crutch, what is your thing. Anyway, so this scene went well as me as high status, and I felt like, you know, when you execute something on a decent level, it becomes part of your DNA. You remember that, you go, oh, okay, I can have high status and low status and everywhere in the middle, and I can play with status. And so comfortable with status and changing your status, I think that helped me navigate those kind of waters.
So how today, when you improvise, how do you give yourself a note or get a note? Because you seem like a guy who wants to keep challenging. You're not done with improv.
No, I mean, in a hippie way or whatever, it's like, you're never really done, right? You don't ever go, I'm done. I've improvised to the best, you know, and you're done. It is an ongoing thing. It's like yoga, or it's very meditative for me to improvise, when I can. And, sometimes the notes come from, bad shows. Like we did a run of Stolen House with a great cast in Chicago last summer, and then we did another run in New York in May, and I felt that I could only look personally as like my shows in Chicago, I felt much more grounded than I did my shows in New York. And there was something different about that. And so I have to pick apart that and really study that.
What did you discover for yourself?
Well, I discovered, I think that I wasn't trusting the environment or trusting that that I would bring something to the environment. So I think I was working too hard and also pushing too hard, perhaps. And just, it's just awareness of like, what does the scene need? And I don't know if I had that that strong awareness in that. But I have an incredible wife who gives me notes at times, which is always helpful if they're delivered properly.
What is the best way to deliver them properly?
We're still trying to figure that out, right, Jimmy, because my poor wife has tried to help me in many ways. And again, that defensive mechanism sometimes kicks in, you know, with the ones you love.
I can relate.
But, you know, it's funny because we've done Weird Ass together for years. And we've had many times where we'd get off stage and be like, so what was that thing you were doing? And, you know, two-person shows with your spouse where you go home with them, it's like there are recipes for disaster if you don't. So we had to set up some guidelines where we don't
tell us the guidelines.
Well, the guidelines are just like our relationship is the most important thing, and that we don't get off stage and give each other notes. There's a period of we don't talk about it right after the show. It's too raw. Everything's too raw, and then maybe a day or two after we can discuss it if we want to. But we don't go in with blame either. It's like, you know, we can't change each other, and both of us have that desire and tendency to, as you know, as we do, and we do best when we accept each other as whatever gifts we're bringing to the scene. So we're trying to be more compassionate towards each other.
Now, my wife and I are in couples therapy. Have you ever thought about couples therapy?
We have, and I think that we could use some of that. You know, it's difficult with kids and all that. I think we just want to be on the same page to raise our kids, you know, and that's our biggest struggle to work on. Like, hey, this is what we want to do, right? Yeah, yeah. No screen. That's what we want to do. They're driving us crazy. No. We're going to commit to no screen. That's just the fun of child raising.
I'm really looking forward to that part. You were also one of the founding members of Baby Wants Candy.
I was not one of the founding members of Baby Wants Candy. I was in an early incarnation of Baby Wants Candy. But I can't say that I was a member. I think, you know, like Peter Gwynn, Mary McCain, maybe Al Samuels and Nick Cannell and others. I know that they were there. They were there doing, they did some shows before they were musical. And then they started becoming musical. And then they asked me to join them once they were musical.
And how was that? Because that's going back in the late, do you remember in the 90s sometime, right?
Yeah, you know, the Lost Jetties were together from 93 to 96. And then for a year, I did shows like Monster Island and with you.
Rich Fulcher and Dwyer was on it, and Noah. Seamus. Stephanie,
yeah.
Sure.
Yep, yep. And then as I was doing Armando, Monster Island kind of dissipated. And I was at that point, was like, am I still going to do this? Because it's, you know... And this is early on in improv, as we know, there wasn't really a trajectory. And I gotta say that I never got into this to do anything other than this. I got hooked on improvisation and was like, I just like this as an end in of itself.
Which is surprising because you started at Second City. You guys were doing some best of material of Second City. Very early on success with your group there. That Second City would have been a goal of yours.
It was a goal. It was a goal. Don't get me wrong. It was a goal, but it wasn't an option. It was like I wasn't getting hired. And
you had auditioned?
I had auditioned. And, you know, again, in the early 90s, I might not have been the best person to put on a tour call.
Why? If you were objective, why?
Oh... Probably because I was had some sort of ego and I was vocal with my opinions of like what we should or shouldn't be doing in ways. Maybe, maybe not. Maybe I was just a jerk. I don't know. It's hard to know. But when I finally did get hired for Tour Co, I remember Kelly Leonard saying to me, he's like, "We almost didn't hire you." And I was like, okay, why? And he's like, "Well, because Sharna was such a big advocate for you that we almost didn't hire you." And I was like, "That makes perfect sense." I don't know why that the relationship of why that would be, but it didn't matter. I toured for 8 months, and it was probably too late for me to tour.
How old were you when you got the job?
God, let's see. So it was like 99 or 2000. Yeah. So yeah. So I was in my early 30s.
Yeah.
Maybe mm-hmm. late 20s.
And most of the people you're touring with are in their 20s.
Well, no, actually, I toured with Al Samuels, who's okay. My age, and Jillian Vigman, and Stuart Ranson. And so we were a good group, and I enjoyed touring with. And Katie Cawson was on our group. What was it, Greenco? No, Blueco. I can't remember. Point is that I had just been... I had been doing a lot of other things since then. And so when I started touring, I had all this freedom, and then touring became a restrictive medium that I don't know if I adapted well to. I mean, I love doing the shows and that, but, I don't know if it's that thing where you don't know. I would have loved to do a Second City review, but it's probably best that I never did, because I have like stronger relationships with the people that I work with now, because we didn't have horrible blowups
So you were anticipating if I got in a review, my ego was so out of whack that I would have alienated people.
That's in hindsight. Hindsight. Like I don't know if that would be, because I don't know if I was a rampant egomaniac. Mm-hmm. I think I was just very. I'm particular, I'll tell you, it's just like eating food. I don't like to consume natural flavors, things with natural flavors. I don't care about the science. I just don't prefer to eat natural flavors. I don't want them. So that makes me picky, right? But I find it to be, that's just a standard I don't want to sacrifice. And so that sometimes comes across as being, difficult. And I don't know if that's what I mean, I might have had the best time ever creating a Second City review. I might not have. And I don't, it really doesn't matter. But I think if I look back at that time, that I wouldn't change a thing. Because I didn't do Second City, we did Trio. I started working with Dasharisky after Trio stopped. And I've been working with them for 17 years. It's like I wouldn't give that up for a run at Second City or anything, and including the shows I did with Quartet or Sextet. We did one off of that, and I felt like it was because I wasn't given the path that I was forced to make decisions of what I wanted to do while I was here, and while I was in Chicago, I felt like I really dove into the improv scene and just lapped it up.
Let's go back to Baby Wants Candy for just a second.
Sure.
We're not sure what date, but it's in the 90s. It's the late 90s. And it's like, no one is doing musical improv in Chicago that I'm aware of at that time.
Right.
And you're doing it as a Herald team at the I.O.
Yeah.
What kind of reaction does it have?
You mean to the audiences?
To the audience.
Oh, I think that they loved it. I think that we loved it. It was.
What did you love about it?
I loved...
Because you weren't a singer, and most of those people who were in there, you had a musical background, but...
Yeah. Well, that was the best thing about Baby Wants Candy. It wasn't musical people creating a musical. It was improv people creating a musical. And I think that's an important distinction. I don't care how good people sing in an improvised musical. That's the difference of a regular musical. And I found that when we were in the early days of Baby Wants Candy, that was the beauty of it. It was like, it was more about the anything can happen. Anybody can get a solo. Everybody's going to support. And it was like a true Herald group mentality. And there was no stars in Baby One's Candy. It was all an ensemble. And we did some wonderfully unexpected scenes in songs in there. I think that as it got more and more popular, I think that people started to be like, it's my turn for a song, you know? And it just changed subtly but distinctly to people that were playing. And I remember one of my last shows, I was like, okay, I've never pushed myself to the forefront and I don't think we're supposed to, so I'm going to step back, which is, you know, the improv mentality of taking care of your partner is very different it's opposite of survival. Right? Taking care of everyone else.
What does that mean to you? Because a lot of people listening to this podcast, taking care of your partner, what does that mean to Bob Dassey?
It's making whatever they do right and accepted and part of the world that you're creating. Making their great or making their crappy idea look great instead of your incredible idea, you know, pursuing that. I think it has a lot to do with being open to their information so that you are truly affected by it. Because I say in my classes that we tend to yes, but we don't yes and. And the and is where my partner says something to me, I can agree with it, but it's like, what is that agreement? What is that? The information that came in, what does that make me want to give back? And that's where the improv comes from. It's not, you're not making shit up. You're pulling from this wealth of knowledge that you've had for your, however long you've been alive. And whatever that is, what if someone says to you, sparks something in your incredible web of mind that might, like if somebody mentioned a dog, I have a dog, I can say something about how I feel about my dog. Someone says something about travel, like I've traveled. Someone says something about something I don't know about. What does that sound like? What does it make me think of? The first thing I think of when I hear that sound. And so letting your partner's words affect you in a constant manner so that it's always two or three people creating one thing versus you driving and someone following, or you following and somebody driving.
So let's take that concept. I'll give you a line. Sure. And if you, I don't mean to put you on the spot.
No.
It always helps if we can demonstrate.
It's something. Always practice, Jimmy. It's always practice. Even in performance, it's practice. We're never doing it perfectly, right? It's not execution. It is always attempt. We're always attempting to do it great.
Yeah. All right. Stan, there's only one piece of cake left.
Oh, you know what, Jimmy, you should have it. It's a day after your birthday. It's your cake.
Stan, I can't do that. I mean, I'm at your house. I mean, I've been here for a week.
Hey, I'm enjoying the celebration. It's a week-long celebration of your birthday. I'm not going to eat your last piece of cake, Jimmy. I insist. You take it. You know what I'm going to do? I'm just going to microwave a burrito.
Really? Can I have some of that too?
Sure thing, Jimmy. You can have whatever. I told you when you came in here, anything in my house is yours. I've given you my bed. You've played with my dog.
I love your dog.
Tiger is great, right?
She's really close to me.
I know.
I want to talk to you about Tiger.
Well, we can talk about Tiger. I mean, I saw you giving her treats. You, one treat a day.
She loves treats from me. She's always she gets jumps on me, and she can hardly wait till I come home. I don't think she's happy with you.
You know, hearing out loud, I can't deny that. That's the truth. She's not happy with me. I don't take care of her. We didn't bond, and I feel like I'm stuck with this dog. Jimmy, if you could take Tiger off my hands, that would be the best thing.
I couldn't do that.
No, I would want you to. She'd
be happy.
I'm going
to do it. I'm going to do it for her.
Thank you. Now eat your cake. Enjoy your birthday.
Okay, so if we broke that down, where are you making the first emotional?
Well, you know,
response
what?
Response to the stand. There's one piece of cake left.
Well, the first thing I'm thinking is justifying the cake. is like, you created a cake. Why would there be a cake in my house? What can, and it could be anything, but I made it, you know, it's your birthday. Mm-hmm. It's your birthday. Day after your birthday, we had some sort of party, and there's a cake, piece of cake mm-hmm. left. I want to give it to you. That's my first instinct off of that. But it could be, cake could have been a wedding. It could have been just a piece of cake. It could mm-hmm. have been just a thing. The other thing I was conscious of is I didn't want to get bothered by you. I didn't want to choose the negative of like, you're intruding on my life. Mm-hmm. Instead, I want to be more open to, this is not a bad thing. You're here for a week and it's great.
Why is that? Why didn't you want to make a negative choice?
Well, because I think that we tend to gravitate to negativity it's a phenomenon. We're supposed to connect with our partner and move forward, running through this dark tunnel mm-hmm. with our hands held and mm-hmm. in all glory. But yet what we tend to do immediately is repel from each other. We come out there and it's like, hey, here's your birthday present. You got me this, you know, and it's immediate because we think that we're latching on to something like anger or negativity is like, I can, it's a tangible thing I can mm-hmm. hold on to. So I try to, don't put me under a microscope, but there's times I would like to pursue the positive because I think it's less explored. What happens if we don't hate each other on stage? What if we like to be with each other? Let's, you know, if I'm going, I'm meeting with Paul Grandi later on. We're going to go with his kids to the park. I'm expecting that to be a wonderful visit, right? Now, what if in a scene he takes me to the park and I hate everything about it? Well, that's just not true. I'm not going to go to a park with Paul Grandi and complain about everything. So that element of truth being we are more positive in real life than we are on stage.
I think you are. I don't think I am. Because I am so negative. The negativity just comes out. But yeah. And to me, it sounds to you, it's like you're aware of it on mm-hmm. stage because sure. we're all negative and yeah, we're all true. Positive.
Yeah.
But you're making a conscious choice of making the positive choice.
Yeah, and you know, there's an article. There's nothing but articles these days, right?
And it's online. I'm sure it's on Facebook.
There's an online article that's been going around. No, but I've been reading up on your synapses and creating new. You know, they say the brain can't. What do they say? I don't know what they say, but the brain is a magical little organ. That we haven't played enough. See the organ thing? Mm-hmm. So, but I was reading about creating new neural pathways. And when you complain, this article mentioned that when you complain, you're creating a shorter distance between two neural pathways. I might be butchering the science here. But the point is that makes going negative easier. And we fall into a rut where we can get stuck in a negative thing. So it is a conscious choice to me, not just on stage, but in general, to try not to complain, number one, which is very difficult. Try not complaining through a day.
How about an hour?
An hour.
Let's I'm start serious.
Baby steps. Yeah. Baby steps. Sure. Sure. But it's just that easy, though, because we can say, oh, there's not enough light in here. Or what a beautiful day. The sun's coming in. Or whatever. It's what we put our focus on. So same thing on stage is what we put our focus on. Do we want to focus on all the problems in a scene? Or do we want to focus on the connection of the relationship? And not solve a problem, but deal with a problem in a fascinating way with two unique individuals.
Also, you mentioned that you and Stephanie do a show called Weird Ass. Uh-huh. You've been doing it for years.
Yes.
And it's very interesting when I go out of town and I teach, you know, it doesn't matter what city, somebody go, well, it's like the Weird Ass form. And it's just, since I've known you guys, there's a sense of like, you know, you just feel proud, you know, you feel happy because, you know, it's a form, you know?
Yeah. It's just a surprise to us. We never intended to create a form with that. And we're not even sure what that form would be like.
So I was going to ask you, you know, they'll mention it and I know a little cause I've seen some of it, but what is it exactly?
Well, as you know, Jimmy, you did Naked with mm-hmm. with Stephanie, which was an early two-person improv show directed by Rob Mallow that was an hour-long show. And that you didn't have a form, right? You were
no, we were just gonna one long scene.
Yeah. So when we started doing Weird Ass, we wanted to put some sort of distinctual drive for us. And the biggest thing we did was this duologue kind of thing that Steph had seen Susan Messing do in class. And so we just took that thing from class and merged it with like the opening of When Harry Met Sally when they're interviewing the old mm-hmm. people. And also an Errol Morris film called Heaven's Gate. No, not Heaven's Gate. Gates of Heaven. Right? Gates of Heaven. It's a documentary about pet cemeteries. And it's a lot of, you know, interviews. Okay. And so we love that aspect of creating two characters at the top in an interview style. Like we start by saying somebody just asked us a question. So then that's how we start based on whatever the suggestion is. And
you're working purely organic here.
Purely organic. Yeah. And then we bookended it. We bookended it. We decided to come back to those two at the end of the show. And so we bookended it. And that was pretty much the most structure we did. We created some devices that we use sometimes in the scene or in the show. And then we've also changed that up. We've done personal monologues. We've done very casual discussions with the audience before we started. We've tried a lot of different things, but we come back to that bookending thing when we do perform.
What is it about Stephanie? I've gotten to work with her. Mm-hmm. I think she's probably easy one of the best improvisers that I've ever worked with.
Totally.
What is it about you that you liked working with her?
Oh, she was never a blank slate. You know, Steph was always making choices. She was always very present in a scene all the time. And, you know, I talk about the first 2 minutes or first minute of scenes that we see where people pace around and stand in silence and nobody makes a choice and everything. It's like, that's wasted time. And I say, as the older I get, time becomes more valuable.
Right, so those 2 minutes.
Don't waste that. That adds up. If you do 100 shows, you've wasted 200 minutes of time. Two times 100. That's what I loved about her. That's what I love about her is that she's always ready to go. And it's not like an upward ramp. It's always like she's very present in the scene. And it makes all the difference when you look across and see somebody on the other side that is ready to play. And I know that when I dip down, that's the thing that I lose is my presence on stage or my connection to my partner. And so I aspire to maintain it, especially when I'm playing with stuff.
You talk about, you know, the walking around 2 minutes, we're killing time before how have you been able to, you know, get that time really short and just get right to the scene?
Well, again, just like the brilliant cake experience that we just had, it's to take things like, I call it snapping into it. Like the world is changed. Like, when you mentioned cake on a table, my brain saw the cake on the table, and it just I took it to that's our new reality. And it's like I play with that level of reality, or at my best, I play to that level of my reality. It's like I don't know if it's sustainable over time. I take breaks and whatnot to try to, but at my best, I'm in the reality that we're creating. The audience fades away and the scene fades away, or the stage fades away until I see the reality that's floating around me. That's just how my mind has always worked. I'm very visual. And when I do object work, I see what I'm doing. Whether anybody else knows what I'm doing, I know what I'm doing. I'm not just futzing.
A suggestion, and then what happens?
Oh.
Knife is the suggestion.
Yeah, it really depends on what form I'm working with.
Right.
But if it's knife, then, and I come out stage, I might just take the ticket verbatim and start using a knife. I might be at a hunting shop, looking for a knife. I might take it to a point where like being stabbed in the back and I'm calling my friend out on their betrayal. It's playing with that concept so you can shoot all those choices in your head in an explosion in kind of a way.
So you'll have three or four choices in your head and you'll pick one. And that will condense that time at the beginning of we're walking around in Jell-O and we don't know what we're doing.
I'll come out right away with something. Now let's say if I take knife verbatim and I just come out and I start cutting something, then I say, what am I cutting? Where am I cutting? And why am I cutting? And I don't say it overtly. I just go, okay, I'm cutting. What am I? And I look at it. It's like, oh, these are potatoes. It's Thanksgiving. You know, that might
be. And that's before anyone delivers a line.
Right. That's just me walking on the stage. I might do that. And I don't know, if, you know, in that order or whatnot. But as soon as my partner says something, everything I have, it doesn't go away. It adapts into what has been added to that. So if I'm cutting something and I'm cutting potatoes and somebody comes in and says, great day for fishing, I might switch to cutting bait, but I don't drop my activity and I don't panic. I just go into,
you just adapt.
Yeah. I just adapt to what's the truth, because I like to say that a two person scene is the way I visualize it is the camera's really close on two people. And as that scene goes on, the camera backs out and more is revealed in the scene of where they're at, what's going on, who they are. And so you get a full picture and then you play in that picture.
Explain to me, when the person comes in and says it's bait, mm-hmm. and you go, that's the truth of the scene.
Oh, again, letting your partner's words affect you is improvising. I think that you're letting that information that's coming in move you forward into the scene, and to ignore that information is not doing what we're supposed to do. So you let that information come in, you let it merge into whatever you have, and that becomes a new reality.
But I'm cutting potatoes. This is Thanksgiving. I'm preparing for Thanksgiving.
There's nothing.
That was my truth.
I know that was your truth. It's fantastic.
Right.
But there's you can continue to cut potatoes if you want. Maybe you're packing lunch for the fishing trip. Okay, and you're in a kitchen. That's fine. The key thing is not to panic, right? You don't go, I'm cutting potatoes. It's like, all right, I'm fishing. Because it's about letting your partner's words give you a reason to speak. So they say this, you go, okay, and I'm going to yes and that with some information back. And slowly, everything's a clue. We look at all the things that are said in the scenes, like, okay, I know that. I think I have an idea, and then you can play. But you could be wrong, too. You could be like, oh, I think he's a guy, and I think he's a girl. And then it quickly turns out like Jim and Tom, and you're like, oh, okay, they're both guys. So it's just like driving. You know, you're driving down a street, you hit potholes, your cars swerve in front of you. You're alert the whole time. You're ready for anything. You drive defensively, Jimmy, so you can survive the trip. You don't just let go of the wheel and go, hey, whatever happens, man. I've said this often, is like my biggest pet peeve is when people say, it's improvisation. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. I think that's the biggest cop-out, because that's like saying music. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Music is perfect, and improvisation is perfect. It's sometimes the people that are playing the instruments aren't that capable.
Okay, but you said to me when we came in here, we did a show, Dazzariski. You had a long travel days on trains and workshops, and you guys didn't feel you had done a show up to your level.
Well, what we felt is that we were working, and when a scene feels like work, then we've never given it the proper foundation on which to play. And so we were trying to play on a very loose foundation. So we couldn't get our footing. And it came back, like we found a lot of things, and we found our survival skills kept us alive, and we felt like we landed okay. We weren't as connected as we like to be.
So when you come off stage, what do you say to each other?
When we came, I was like, so how do you guys feel? And we kind of bounced around a little bit and we pick at it. We go, yeah, that felt good. It's like, I don't know about that. And yeah, I think I did this and I felt like this. And so we just talk about it, but there's never any blame or anything like that. We've been performing long enough to know that, you know, sometimes you fire on all cylinders and sometimes you don't. And like I said, we had a long travel day and we taught classes before and my voice is a little scratchy and you know, all these, there's plenty of excuses. that they're not meant to be excuses. They're just elements that affect your performance. Because everything that's in our life affects our improv when we get up on stage. That's kind of the fun of it.
So what is the adjustment you're going to make for tonight's show?
I've got plenty of rest, Jimmy. I'm hoping my my partner's got plenty of rest. They're teaching today. I think just to be more patient at the top and to let it unfold with more patience and reverence than to, you know, fools rush in.
You are so, I don't know, you must really work on yourself since I've known you. Would you say that's true? And how have you worked on yourself? There's a calmness. Is there meditation going on?
There's meditation, yes. Okay. I've just recently started transcendental meditation.
It's something I've always wanted to do. You know what scares me about it?
What's that?
The price.
The price is something, and you know what? We don't even have to, I don't want to divulge into a conversation about that, because really, in a way, it's more of a donation to help people to do this. I don't even know. I don't even care.
Okay.
The thing is, I needed to calm my mind. I'm anxiety ridden. I have defensive mechanisms that come in, and
give me one of your defense mechanisms. Because I don't see you as a defensive guy.
Give me a harsh note, okay. and then I will maybe struggle with it. I won't just go, "That's very good."
Will you argue with it? If I said, "Oh, you know, Bob, I think you were in too many scenes."
My wife has had many experiences of me arguing with notes. We debate them, and I feel that debate is healthy. But at the same time, and it's also, there's not one way. There's not one answer, but. Where my defensive mechanism comes in is that it slows my growth. And if I'm trying to grow and trying to learn, and of course in this business, doing everything from wanting to make better relationships or wanting to be better in auditions or better an actor, better performer, better anything. If you want to be better, this work above a lot of work is that you got to be a better person, you know, because if you want to be a better bass player, you sit there and you practice your bass. If you want to be a better human being, you got to practice being a human being. And it's the older I get, Jimmy, the more I've noticed how difficult it is to be a good human being in the face of everything that's coming, that everything that we let into our stratosphere. The things that we read about, the things that are coming in on TV, the screens, so much stuff is coming in through screens. We're getting all that information. But the question is, how much information do we need, and what kind of information, what does that information do to our mentality? Are we afraid when we walk out in our street? Should we be afraid? Everything's telling us to be afraid all the time. So should we be afraid all the time and just hide in our holes? I think they would like that. Those people. I put a lot of attention towards my mindset and there's a thing called a growth mindset and a fixed mindset. Have you heard of this?
No.
The fixed mindset is the very stuck mindset where you think I don't have the examples, but it's opposite of the growth mindset, where the growth mindset is you get a note. Okay, so let's say you do something and you fail. The fixed mindset says, forget it. I don't want to do that anyway, which is helpful because it weeds out some things.
Right, it's how I've lived my whole life.
Exactly, yeah. Yes. But the growth mindset goes, I failed. What can I learn from that failure and do it differently next time? If you want to pursue something, then the growth mindset in that situation is better. Like, you don't just walk away and go, forget it. I don't want to do that anyway. If you really want to do it. I want to be more of a growth mindset. I want to be more open to learning from my mistakes. And some mistakes I've learned from, some I haven't. And it's a continuous process. I'm by no means, you know, I'm glad I come across as I've worked on myself. I think I've tried to, and the meditation has helped put my mind at peace.
You know, you hear about meditation. One of the benefits is become more creative. There we go.
Creative.
How has it helped you with your improv?
You know, I haven't been doing it so long, and this is like the first, this Dasarysky trip has been the first chunk of heavy improv because I took the summer off. How has it helped me with my improv? You know, in general, it's just made me more at ease at where I am, and just being grounded, at being present and in the moment is the best thing for improv. Because again, you want to look across and see your, connect with your partner's eyes, and they're in the same place you're at. You're in the same place, this artificial world, and you're running forward again in the dark tunnel, holding hands gleefully. And that, I think meditation has helped me to do that, to just to be able to be grounded and present a little bit more, not all the time, because I still get, I still fly off the handle. I mean, I mentioned earlier that off mic was that, you know, growing up outside of Chicago and in this weather, my persona is a lot like Chicago weather. It's all over the place. And I'm trying to get myself to be more consistent. A consistency of my personality is what I really am striving for. So I don't have extreme highs or extreme lows. It's like I'm not bipolar, but I'm definitely, I like to drive around.
Because you mentioned anxiety. Even back in Chicago, I didn't see anxiety.
Oh, come on. You never saw me at the end of the bar staring into a beer? I did that a lot. What did I do? What do you call it when you're sitting at the end of the, I brood about things. I think all the time, you know, overthink stuff, you know, bounce stuff around in my head. And that's the thing I want to quiet. It's like, I don't want to overthink stuff. I just want to walk away from something and go, that was what it was. And I don't have to, cause you can't put thoughts in other people's minds. You can't assume people think the way that you want them to think. You just have no power over their minds.
That's probably why for you improv is meditative, because yes. You aren't thinking. You can only think about the last thing that was said.
It's very true. I got to it originally and felt like a fish to water, because it was like, oh, you can. There was an incredible freedom in improvisation. There still is, where you can say and do anything. And I had a lot in my head as an anxiety ridden youth, and so it was like, oh, this is a great place to spout everything. But then over time, I mellowed in a sense where it's speaking what you feel and what you believe, and it's a conduit for that, and using your entire life as the canvas for that. Being on stage is very meditative for me. Especially when we get into that wonderful place where the show is pulling you forward, and you're just part of it, and that is very meditative. When you're just in it, and you're the things that are coming out of your mouth, they're not planned; they're instinctual. You're thinking from your gut versus from your head, and so yeah, when I can turn this thing off, I'm pointing to my brain, it's really the best, because then I'm totally in the moment. Now you need constructive thought, and I don't want you to be unconscious when you're on stage. But to be in that moment is a very, very,
and what you're talking about is being in the zone.
Totally. That's being in that zone.
How often do you think you are in that zone?
I don't know. Proportionally, you mean?
Yeah. Give me a percentage. 70%, 80%, 60%.
All I know is that I try to get in that zone every show. With varying degrees of success. I don't know if it's, because you can't say it's you're in the zone or you're not in the zone. It's like there's zone moments and elements. I mean, I can't put a percentage on it only because I don't know. Like, you know, the five shows, we did three shows in Kansas City and two shows in St. Louis, and each one of those felt very different. All the shows were very different, but all of us, because we spent so much time together, we all felt very, very connected and very in the zone-like. So, you know it when you're not in the zone, right? You know, because I always say that if you taped your show and you put it up on the screen, you would look at it and go, oh yeah, there's a mistake. We did that wrong there. You could point out all the things that go wrong. But when something goes right, you can't really identify why that went right. It's like all of these different things had to happen for this one thing to happen. And so you can't teach the right. You know, you can't, you basically, the way I teach is that I was like, all right, these are all the things that will help us get to the possibility of getting into the zone. Nothing's guaranteed, but if we try to do these things and we take care of each other and take care of all these things, then maybe, just maybe, something like that could happen.
So you, how long have you been out to NLA now?
15 years.
And you went when Stephanie got the job at Man TV?
Yeah, she was getting ready to move to Los Angeles, and I realized I would probably be the stupidest thing I could do to lose her. So I asked her to marry me, and she said yes. She did her first season of Man TV and came back. We got married, and then we drove out to Los Angeles.
Let me ask you this, because I struggle with jealousy. I struggle, anyone I worked with before, I'm jealous of.
Sure.
Stephanie, certainly I'm jealous of, and of Tina Fey and Adam McKay, Dave Koechner, the list goes on and on.
Uh-huh.
How do you deal when Stephanie gets Man TV? She becomes famous.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that?
At first, I honestly was just proud of her. She did it. She did such a great job on that show, and it was such a perfect outlet for her, because the world was so less cutthroat. It was really a great place for her to shine, and I love that she did that. I think in the beginning, I was like, you know, because I've auditioned for some of those things, and I realized over time that I didn't know what I wanted. I didn't know what I wanted to do. Like I said, I was doing computers, and I got into improvisation, and I saw all these people going in different directions to do these different things. And I was like, oh, that'd be cool to do that. Or that would be cool to do that. And I never really knew what I wanted to do. So in the beginning, I'd be like, oh, that'd be cool to do that with my TV or whatever. But it wasn't a passion that I was driving towards. It was just like I was available for it. So in the beginning, I'm sure I had like a what about me mentality of like, wait, I'm doing stuff. Why didn't anyone pick me? And that's just the wrong way to look at it. It's there's a great Confucius quote that says, don't be worried about recognition. Be worried about being worthy of recognition. I'm paraphrasing, but in other words, be the best that you can be. And drive, if you want to do something, drive towards that, but don't let it be an obsession where you then cloud your ability, because you could, like, that's back to Second City. I was like, I knew I could do Second City. I knew it.
Well, everybody was also saying, why don't they hire Bob Dassey for years? You must have heard that, right?
Well, people ask me stuff, but the thing is, I, as much as I wanted to do it, I don't know if that was my passion. Now, and over time, I've been asking myself what it is I do want to do. And I've had the glorious opportunity to be at home with my kids and turn to writing, which I find is meditative as well. So I think the worst thing you can do in this business, or in any business in the world, is look around. There's a yoga thing. When you're doing yoga, it's like if somebody next to you can do a handstand, it doesn't matter that they're doing a handstand. That's where they're at. Where you're at is still trying to do a good dog face down and just be there and get better where you're at, because it doesn't matter where everybody else is at. In the big picture, the more existential I get, Jimmy, which is quite existential lately,
right.
Is, you know, when you question the purpose of everything, when you show pictures of the universe and you go, oh, this is pointless. You have to say, what is in your immediate life is what is important. This is what I've been doing, is I'm trying to take care of where everything that is immediately around me, trying to do all that really well. And it's, you know, you asked me about balance. It's like, it is a constant balance. You do a little of this, you do a little of that. You want more time for this. You try to make more time for that. You give each other more time, and it's a dance. And it's a lot of work. But it's work worth doing, because I think it delves into your peacefulness. If that's what I want, is peace of mind. You know, that's what
over
I
over success, over fame, over money,
over life, just okay. Peace of mind. Unlike,
I'm not there yet.
No, I don't. That's again, it's like, I don't know when we ever get there, but it's the pursuit. It's the pursuit of that. Just like when you're on stage, you pursue the relationship in a scene, right? that out in life, I pursue the relationship with life. I'm trying to, like, this all makes sense. I'm supposed to be right here doing this. And, you know, it can be tricky if you look at other people's successes, but you know, they're all doing different things. And the question is, what am I doing? That's what my question is.
We've got to wrap this up, and we always end the podcast with the same question. What piece of advice would you give to an improviser in comedy, starting out in comedy and improv today?
Well, honestly, I'm not the best person to get the advice from, but I will give some advice. All right, here's what my advice would be. Know what you want to do, and if you want to do it, learn how to do it very well for free, because you're only going to get paid for it if you do it really well. So if you can do it really well and you love doing it and you're doing it for free, then that's love, all right? But you got to make sure you love it. If you're doing anything just waiting and looking at the clock and looking at the phone and waiting and wondering, then you're just going to get bitter. And I think that's silly. And also remember this, that the grass is always greener. As soon as you step behind the curtain, it all changes. I remember the first time I stepped behind the curtain at a Second City show. And when I put up those shows at the Second City Northwest, it was like, oh, this is all very different now. You go from being an admirer of a form to being to doing that form. And it's just a very different perspective. So I don't envy anyone, because if they're doing what they want to do, then great. I'm doing what I want to do. And I don't know, you know, and when I get to spend the day with my kids and my wife and my dog, and it's like, that's perfect. And I don't need to be anywhere else. And so you be where, what's the thing, Ram Dass, be here now kind of thing.
Okay.
It's all that kind of shit, right? It's all that hippie shit. And I love it. I love that it's coming back. Because I think that,
are you a big reader of that stuff?
I have been over time. I've read a lot of, like, Hermann Hesse, all of those, Eckhart Tolle. I've read all those things.
Power of Now.
Yeah. And not necessarily, I don't consider them self-help books, but I consider them like, again, like I said, I want peace of mind. I want to get a hold of what's going on in my head. And, I think, and so back to the advice is that is know yourself, know what you want to do, and then pursue it. But pursue it because you love it, not because other people are doing it and you think it looks cool.
Bob Dassey, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
My pleasure, Jimmy. Thanks for having me.
And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. I want to thank our guest, Bob Dassey. I've known Bob for a long time. And I love everything he had to say. And I'm just so impressed how mellow he is and peaceful and serene, and hopefully that is something I'm attaining to get in my life. I may never get there, to be honest with you, but I'm shooting for that. I would love to be more like Bob is. Also would like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. If it wasn't for Dan, you wouldn't be hearing my voice right now. I don't want to forget Ian Getz, who recorded this episode. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv classes, The Art of Slow Comedy, and workshops and intensives, go to my website, jimmycorain.com. Also sign up for my Improv Nerd blog. Check us out on Facebook and like us. Please, please, please like us on Facebook. Also, follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd, and our wonderful YouTube channel, which is Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word, Improv Nerd Podcast, all one word, and see clips from our live shows. Also, we're lucky to be part of this podcast collective called FeralAudio.com. They're doing some of the coolest podcasts out there. They're hilarious, innovative, funny. People like Dino and Andy, people like Todd Berry, Dan Harmon, Chelsea Peretti, Steve Agee, Jimmy Corain. I love sticking my name in at the end there. So go to FeralAudio.com for that. And thank you for listening. Until next time, remember, walk, don't listen.
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
It might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you and Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Sonfeld, I love having you fuck